What's good, New York? You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI listener-funded radio, 99.5 FM. Today, we'll be covering the headlines from a socialist perspective. Then we'll be discussing U.S. imperialism in South and Central America before speaking with some immigration rights activists, including some comrades who just came back from Tijuana. But before we dive in, let's go to the headlines from Michael.
Extra, extra, news from the Central Committee. Electrical failures at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Sunset Park left inmates with no access to heat or hot water during the coldest week of the winter so far. As of 10 p.m. Monday, the lights and heat were back on and legal action is in progress. The city and the federal government reached a deal that will see the Housing and Urban Development take more control of the New York City Housing Authority while stopping short of a full federal takeover. The new agreement comes after a federal judge rejected an earlier deal in November as insufficient. Senator Julia Salazar, District 18, North Brooklyn, proposed a bill that would require landlords in market-rate housing to provide justification to raise rents more than 3.3%, effectively protecting all New York tenants from exorbitant rent increases. An Amazon executive told a city council hearing that he would oppose unionization efforts by workers at the proposed HQ2 campus. Meanwhile, the Teamsters joined the coalition against Amazon's NYC plans, and even Cuomo's office made a statement criticizing Amazon's unionization stance. Lyft and Juno have sued to block a minimum wage law that benefits New York City for hire vehicle drivers. Corey Johnson has already announced that he's considering running for mayor in 2021. Johnson committed on Twitter to refuse individual donations over $250. And will accept zero money from real estate developers, lobbyists, or PACs. Zero is in quotes. The final count of candidates to qualify for the ballot in the February 26th Public Advocate Special Election is 17. Council members Brad Lander, District 39 Park Slope, and Helen Rosenthal, District 6 Upper West Side, have declared their intentions to run for comptroller in 2021. Along with other borough and citywide races, the field may balloon due to the vast majority of sitting council members who will be term limited in 2 years. Assemblymember and public advocate candidate Michael Blake, District 79, Morrisania, consulted for a Bermudan political party for 2 years without registering as a, quote, foreign agent under federal law.
Thank you for the great reading of the headlines, Michael. Now we are going to transition into our conversation about U.S. imperialism in Central and South America with our special guest, Luigi. But before diving into the historical context, I just wanted to make the audience aware that in this past week, 5,000 U.S. troops have landed in Colombia in their effort alongside Brazil and Colombia to overthrow the government, democratically elected government in Venezuela. This is part of a long and terrible history of U.S. intervention and imperialism south of the border. It goes back, 200 years, but this, specific iteration can really be seen with a CIA intervention in Guatemala in 1954, which brought about a series of overthrows and counter-revolutions against liberation movements. And the U.S. policy, if you actually ask some former CIA officials themselves, was based upon the Nazis' shock doctrine, essentially, to break liberation movements into submission. So we have Luigi, who's going to dive in more fully on that. And Luigi, if you just want to tell us a little about yourself and why you have a unique perspective on this.
Hi, I am from Argentina, so sorry because English is not my first language. But in my country, I have been a socialist for the last 10 years. So we have been involved in many movements against U.S. intervention, U.S. imperialism, but also to all the activities that U.S. has in previous dictatorship in our country. We are fighting to have justice for that too.
Is there any specific interventions? If we go back to the U.S. and Argentina in the 1970s, backing the military dictatorship, is there what's the best way to kind of like summarize this history to give people a real understanding of the vicious brutality and why the U.S. is constantly attacking governments that are, you know, fighting for working people in Central and South America.
No, yes, you make a good point going back to the 50s, because yes, it is a long story, but we can draw a line in 1950. There were two very important moments that were the revolution in Bolivia in 52, and then in 59 you had the Cuban Revolution, one here in front of the US and the other one in the other corner of the continent. So those two moments opened like a very interesting process in the whole Latin America, a lot of movements that were fighting against imperialism, but capitalism too, and these ideas of socialism were being talked every day, just like now, but with the discussion about how to win, how to be able to break this U.S. Power.
Exact. So, I mean, I think it's critical making that connection between imperialism and capitalism. Like in Guatemala in the 1950s, it was United Fruit owned most of the land there, and Alan Dulles, who was the director of the CIA at the time, was actually an investor and on the board of United Fruit. So there's a very direct connection between the ownership of property and the desire to push for counter-revolution. Bringing this to the current refugee crisis, what responsibility does American imperialism have for, you know, the flow of migrants who are being forced out of their homes in Central America?
I guess if we want to find a way of measure the responsibility, we can say 99% or 95%. In the 70s, they destroy a lot of the working class movement. There were workers that were defying the power inside the factories so that they can raise the wages, they can have more benefits, work less hours, etc. And that means losing a lot of money for U.S. companies. One of the ideas is for them to destroy all this resistance so that then in the 80s, 90s, they can apply this neoliberalism through the whole continent as they don't have any more resistance or opposition to go ahead with those plans. What else?
Well, I think you can like very specifically look at the dirty wars in the 1980s, in which the U.S. is supporting these death squads. They're training their leadership, and it is completely like pillaging and destroying these liberation movements. Like hundreds of thousands of people were killed in these efforts, and from that point, you see a spike in the amount of people who have to flee where they live. But this is completely erased. So just out of curiosity, what role does the war on drugs have within this overall context? Like, how is that related to U.S. imperialism? And how has that kind of created these devastating situations for all these innocent people who are just trying to live their lives and empower themselves?
No, that is a huge intention of the U.S. to keep all these drug traffic outside of U.S. It's like here drugs can enter, but they don't want all this mess that has the Central America. So with funding, with money, and with different trades, they also have power and decision about the army of Mexico, Colombia, and all the countries that are in that path. So they can take decision at the same level of if they were part of the government of those countries. And they also need to keep in control those gangs. It's like, okay, they have some freedom to do business, to do things in the illegal market, but at the same time, they have to have certain control of it. So they intervene more aggressive in some moments, but in others, they give money, power, guns, to let them grow. And in many moments, they also have so much power that they can defy the state. There are some regions that are being led by these groups that they have the chance to give benefits or replace the welfare status of the state, so that they also can have a lot of people in favor. But at the same time, this brings murders, traffic of human beings, and a lot of violence that people can run away from, because you also can't find a job. So economic and drug is both are together.
Yeah, especially since, like as you're kind of describing, a lot of these cartels becomes intertwined in the local ruling class in these countries. And if they're working with the U.S., then they're fine as long as they're not standing in the way. A lot of the heads of the cartels now are, these gangs that are operating in Central America, where their leadership was trained at the School of the Americas in the United States during the 1980s. So this is continuing to have this impact. So how is U.S. imperialism expressing itself in South and Central America today?
Now, for example, after the Pink Tai government, they are pushing forward to have more right wings. You have the Bolsonaro in Brazil, Macri in Argentina, Piñera in Chile. Trump also is giving congrats to all these new right-wing governments. And now you have the recent intervention in Venezuela, that the people who works for this government has said in front of millions in the TV that they are there for the oil, and if the oil companies can have access to control those resources, that will be benefits for Americans. So American First is not only for national politics, it is the same imperialist politics towards the backyard of Latin America.
Yeah, the desire to control the resources and work, because there are the local elites who benefit from the relationship. I mean, it's as old as colonialism, that kind of symbiotic relationship between the two, a powerful faction locally who benefits from the U.S. Backing, and then working together to destroy any sort of revolutionary movement that is going to empower working people, that's going to empower peasants. The constant desire to maintain these hierarchical forms of domination, and so that the U.S. can keep extracting resources or pumping capital in and out of these places, which then spurs massive social upheaval.
No, yes, totally. And I think when we say U.S., it's important to clarify that are both parties. It is a long story, so sometimes Republicans, sometimes Democrats. But now if you follow the media of the main Democrat mainstream website, all of them are attacking to the Maduro regime, but not to thinking how to improve it or saying the problem that they have. They are saying that is socialism. Socialism is condemned to fail. So they are using that, I think, to all this new generation here in the U.S. that is thinking that socialism is something appealing. They're saying, no, look, Venezuela is failing. So it's important that Pink Tides aren't socialist government, but even though they have some resistance and fight against imperialism, for the U.S., that is too much. So they don't want any kind of regulation or control. And in a moment of international crisis, they need profit.
Yeah, in the sense that, there was always this kind of line, oh, Chavez is the bad one, but Lula, he's the good one. Yeah. We he's working with capital, so we're happy to have him. And then as soon as there's this kind of oil crisis, which obviously affects Venezuela, but it also the decline in prices of commodities internationally starts to lead to some sort of economic strife where Brazilian capitalists and American capitalists can't draw as much. They completely undermine the Brazilian regime in a judicial coup d'etat. So it doesn't matter if you're a tepid social democrat or if you even, the absurd thing with the critiques of socialism is causing the problems in Venezuela is that it has nothing to do with any socialist policies, the economic crisis there. It's one driven by U.S. imperialism, sanctions. And then there's just internal mismanagement that almost has to do with keeping a lot of the basically private ownership in power. Like, Venezuela is not a socialist society. The workers don't own the means of production. It's a social democracy fighting against U.S. imperialism.
No, yes, totally. I think all the Pink Tide government has that issue that they didn't go deeper to socialize means of production, giving the workers the chance to decide about what to do with that production, or to break. I know in Venezuela you have more than 6,000 of U.S. companies, so there never were like such a huge break.
Well, I could talk about this all day, and I really want to thank Luigi for joining us for an excellent conversation on the history and the now of U.S. imperialism in South and Central America. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI Radio in New York, at broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. WBAI is not only funded by our listeners, but our board is democratically elected by our small-dollar funders. Do you want to hear more socialist content like you're hearing right now? Become a WBAI buddy by going to give to WBAI.org. $10 or more a month makes you a sustaining member, or you can call 516-620-3602 or text WBAI to 41444. Thank you very much. We've been talking about the history of U.S. imperialism as it relates to the refugee crisis and the caravan. But now we're going to hear from our comrades who witnessed the effects of the crisis firsthand. They will speak to the crisis on an individual level and about their experience supporting people who are waiting in Tijuana for the chance to apply for asylum in the U.S. But first, we're going to go to audio from our comrades from down there.
Now we're going to listen to some excerpts from some of our nightly reflections in Tijuana when we spent time processing what we saw and experienced each day.
I mean, like, one of the first things we did at the documentation station is this guy comes over and starts, like, I don't know, we couldn't really communicate with him super well, and, like, there was some issue, like, a technical issue we couldn't really solve. We had to try to, like, ask a couple different people to figure it out. And meanwhile, someone else started trying to help him. And then it just got really confusing because then we were like, wait, no, we were helping him. And he started telling us the story. And it's like, we want to involve more people. And then turns out he just, like, also really wanted to, like, talk about his story and, like, what's going on with him. I mean, it sounds like he's, like, super traumatized and been through, like, a lot. And he starts, like, asking us, he's like, could you imagine... Like, imagine you had 5 brothers and 4 of them were killed and you only have 1 brother left. And I'm just like, dude, I'm so sorry. Like, also because my Spanish doesn't allow me to say more complex things like that, but like...
Yeah.
What do you say? It was really hard. Like, that was starting the day and then it was just kind of like feeling like, okay... What can we even do for this guy? Like, clearly he needs, like, he should talk to, like, a counselor.
Like, that's when I get emotional. Mm-hmm. Is when I'm experiencing, like, this work through everybody else's eyes. Mm-hmm. Like, the woman that was describing interacting with that woman who was LGBTQ and, like, uh-huh. was, like, wait, I could marry a woman in the United States.
Oh my god.
I was that, like,
did you see the man start weeping?
Mm-hmm. And the one about, like, the dad who got to call his daughter. Mm-hmm. And, like, who hadn't been able to talk to his daughter. The thing that got me on that story was, like, he got to call his daughter. He hadn't been able to call his daughter for 2 days. And just the look of relief, that, like, started to get me. Mm-hmm. And then it was, like, and they printed out a picture for him. Yeah. Which is, like, sweet. But that just means that this person is away from his family because his life is at threat. Mm-hmm. And he didn't even get to have a photo of his daughter mm-hmm. on him. Mm-hmm. He had to have some, like, friendly people at a up anarchist space, like, print off a fuzzy black and white photo of his... super fuzzy, pixelated black and white photo of his daughter. And, like, that's all... That's, like, probably made his day. And it was, like, that kills me.
But also what all of this is up against. Like, you have a... Every day here, you have, like, a much stronger sense of, like, just how much wealth and force and labor and violence is arrayed against, like, these people at such a monumental scale who are just people. Like, they're just, you know, like, you go down into the workshop clinic floor and there's just children and there's moms and dads and they're sick, some of them, and some of them are healthy, but all of them are scared and all of them are worried and all of them are being painted back home as, like, this, like, really foreboding, like, insidious enemy. And they're not. They're just people. They're just these people. It's so being up in the office, you also see, it's such an impressive amount of work is being done to try and help them, but also by these people who are just people, just working class people who are taking time out of their lives to, like, try and, like, help just a few of these migrants be able to find safety, to find a home. And they're all burnt out. Like, everyone who's been around for a while, who's been volunteering in, like, sort of the core organizing group is clearly, like, sick. All of them are passing around the same flu and, like, stretched and tired and, like, waking up every morning and just doing it over and over again and, like, in the face of, like, the largest and most expensive, like, border security operation probably known to man right now. It's wild. It's, like, really, really wild. And then at the same time, you end the day, like, kind of circling up with everybody, and you see, too, that just, like, it's not also who you fully expect to be in the room, like, volunteering to do this. It's people from... It's, like, people who look like my mom and people who look like anarchist kiddos and people who look just like college students or doctors or nurses and law students. They're just like everybody. And I think it's both the saddest and the most inspiring thing about it is that it's just... It's all just normal people trying to help normal people out in the face of other people who are just trying to take advantage of these people's pain and these people's situation because it's politically expedient to, like, whatever sort of fascist they have planned. But, like, it's just normal people trying to help other normal people. Yeah, it gets more like grounded to me every day about just how ruthless this is, like, the effect on just like humans who are going to, like, absorb all of this trauma for the rest of their lives and probably pass it in ways that they're aware or unaware of, but, like, it's truly, like, a very large violence being done to people.
Well, that was just Maddie, Martha, and Jordan, who you're going to hear from right now. First, we'll be speaking with Maddie and Martha, if you guys want to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Martha.
Hi, I'm Maddie.
All right, well, we can just dive right in. So what's happening on the ground, and what are people facing while waiting at the border?
So we were there for a little over a week, and we were able to observe some things and kind of experience what's going on there. It was, you know, we just want to start by saying that we're not the experts, and we were learning then and still are now. The situation there is constantly changing, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. So, you know, which of course is itself a barrier to people being able to cross the border and seek asylum. But, you know, we can explain what we learned and what we saw to the best of our ability. But kind of to set the scene for what we saw when we were there, there's this area called Chaparral, and it is right on the border. So it's, we went to the border crossing. Like, this is the same place that at the end of our trip, we walked right across. And this is an area right now where there's a big open square, and people go there to get numbers, and the numbers enable them to cross the border at some point. So right now there's a bunch of people that have to go there every morning wondering if their number is going to be able to be called, wondering if they can get a number. And it's a pretty surreal scene with both people from, you know, migrants there from the caravan, a lot of police officers, a lot of Mexican police officers, and members of the Mexican ICE group called Grupos Beta.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize that what we did there and the capacity in which we went to El Chaparral was to help out with some legal observing with a group that we were volunteering with. And it was almost intentionally ambiguous, the lack of information that people received and the lack of like systemic support that people got from the state. So it was really unclear how many numbers were going to be called. You know, each number represented a group of 10 people. And when we were there, which was, you know, for 10 days, the lowest number of people that were called for their CFI interview, their credible fear interview, was as low as 18. And then other days it was as high as 60. And there was no system for how people would know this, right? And it seemed to be U.S. Customs and Border Patrol collaborating with Grupos Beta, which is as if, you know, ICE had a humanitarian arm, that would be Grupos Beta on the Mexican side, who would then, you know, share that information with list managers who were themselves members of the caravan at some point. And sometimes the list is described as if it's migrant run, as if they want this system, but metering is completely illegal and folks' hands are tied. And they're doing the best that they can in this situation. So it's important to acknowledge that if you're waiting in Tijuana to do your CFI interview and you're not on the list, you're wasting your time. But at the same time, to take an adversarial position to the list because it's completely illegal. The U.S. is, you know, accepting 18 people a day at some point. We can do so much more. And it's egregious and it shouldn't exist.
So what we learned about the way asylum works is that anyone is supposed to be able to cross the border at any time, cross the border or get on U.S. soil and be able to start the process of applying for asylum. But that's not what's happening. Instead, there's this illegal metering system that Maddie talked about. And we learned that this actually didn't start with this large group of migrants known as a caravan. It actually started in 2016 with a group of Haitian immigrants that were when a large group came to Tijuana at the same time. And so this is an illegal system that's just being facilitated by both the U.S. and Mexican governments working together to create this chaotic system that is really dangerous. And just, again, to go back to the scene in Chaparral, there's kids running around, there's families carrying luggage, there's you know, people trying to find each other. And we learned that there's also people being kind of hunted down and searched for at that place, people who are trying to escape violence. So it's a pretty crazy place to be.
Yeah, I feel like this really like puts in perspective, kind of makes these kind of broader discussions that we were having before about imperialism. This is like affecting real people on the ground. Like, these are human beings. It's like, what, like, for these people going through this like really horrific system, like, what can they expect like after their number is called?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's worth saying that in the capacity that we were volunteering, we were preparing people for the worst case scenario, because that's just what you have to be prepared for in a situation like this. Worst case scenarios included folks being placed in hileras or ice boxes after they made their way across the border, which is this really vile system with very little oversight. People are placed into freezing cages. They're not given a change of clothes, which was that really hit home the week that we were there, because it was just very rainy and everyone's clothes were wet all the time. So that would, like, your clothes would freeze. not being given fresh food, not being fed on a regular basis. Often the food was rotten. And again, there's just like very little oversight onto this process. And then, you know, say that you weren't placed into detention. On the other side of the border in San Diego, there are very little beds. Like the week that we were there, there were 6 beds open. So there's just kind of this gross negligence on the part of the U.S. state to accommodate people who have right to be there, like per their own, you know, hoops that folks have to jump through. And then also, you know, oftentimes people are placed into detention and you're sent off to, you know, whatever state. We saw a lot of folks being sent to California and San Diego. And something that's really important to know is that that really defines whether or not your asylum case is accepted. You know, if you're placed into a detention center in California, there's a 90% acceptance rate of asylum cases. But if you're sent to Georgia, there's a 2% acceptance rate. So there's just, you know, an egregious amount of fate kind of applied to this process.
Yeah, the fact that it's so arbitrary like that is just pretty horrific and inhumane. And a part of that, too, that we learned is that unaccompanied minors, people who are under 18 who are not traveling with a parent, are actually not allowed to get on this list. So a lot of them arrive in Tijuana seeking safety and trying to cross, and they just cannot right now. So several of them have been murdered, and that's all we know. And there's advocates working to try and change that, but that's the situation right now.
I feel like what this like all makes really clear is kind of like the contradiction between like what the law is supposed to be and how it's like really done. It's like under, you know, capitalism, imperialism, that it's power that determines it. So like, how did you experience asylum law and practice versus like, how is it supposed to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think we alluded to this a little bit earlier, but the metering system is completely illegal. You're not supposed to, the U.S. government is not supposed to say only 18 people can cross the border a day to apply for asylum, to go through this like really awful CFI interview in which you're handcuffed, in which the interview is conducted in English. But that kind of doesn't matter because the government is going to enforce laws and they're going to adapt to laws that are being challenged because they have the power to do so. So we really want to recognize that challenging the legal system is important, but no matter the laws, it matters kind of who is enforcing them.
And also, I mean, the laws themselves are totally unjust, and the system of applying for asylum was created, you know, partly out of history of U.S. relations with other countries. Like, it's an arbitrary system. It is not something to be defended in itself. So, you know, even these bare minimum protections are not, you know, are not like fighting within that system. There's so many limitations.
It almost seems like the system is designed, and then even more so its practice as a means of like dehumanizing people, like taking away their value as like real people and turning them into just these like abstract hordes to like drive up fear on the other side of the border where we are. So like, what stories struck with you, and did you meet anyone you connected with? And like, how did this humanize these like these people who are suffering under conditions that most of us couldn't even imagine?
Yeah, I want to preface this by saying that I don't know if it's right to like valorize people or kind of create political objects out of people, because oftentimes, you know, migrants were just reacting to the conditions in their home countries and heading to the border because of that. But I did meet one individual, and I'm going to be intentionally vague, who was fleeing violence or political oppression in their home country. And I was working with them closely for 2 days. And during that time, they showed me, you know, pictures and videos of them fighting in the streets with their friends for a political cause. And there were videos of them giving a speech and pictures of them at a march with all of their comrades. And then, you know, all of these really joyous scenes cut really quickly to like blood on the ground and people horribly maimed. And then, you know, the videos switched to this individual like singing, but no longer with their comrades, and they were alone. And in that moment, and not to sound trite, but I was just like, this person was doing the exact same things that me and all of my friends do all the time. So that kind of put in perspective for me the importance of, I don't know, fighting for like anti-fascist causes and caring about that and contributing if you can or supporting. Because, yeah, this individual was fleeing their country for things that we now have the opportunity to do all the time.
And one thing that stood out to me is a family that I met who was a really young family. I think they were 18 and 19, and they had a small child, and the woman was pregnant, and just seeing how young they were and then hearing their story, I was kind of looking at some of their paperwork that they had, and they were actually threatened just that morning in Chaparral when they were there trying to get a number, and just realizing that, you know, kind of seeing my friends and family members and this young couple and just thinking of everything that they're going through. And, you know, something that Maddie and I talked about a lot when we were there, because we spent some time working with the kids, is, you know, it's kind of uniquely upsetting to work with kids in the way that you know that some of the trauma that they're experiencing is probably going to, you know, carry over for their whole lives, and particularly if they're separated from their families, you know, particularly if their family members are put in detention and or deported and all that. But we also wanted to make sure we talked about the fact that, you know, children are not uniquely innocent. Like their parents have every right, the same right that they do, to want to live a safe and you know, a safe and happy life and all that. So we just wanted to be, we want to make sure we counter any narrative about like good and bad immigrants, and, you know, but it was really tough working with some of the kids, because there's so many young kids and so many young families that are really, that are trying to travel.
Yeah, I think what it like really highlights is like the absurdity of these good or bad immigrants, that these are all human beings and they've been through these like horrible experiences, and the real difference here is not like good or bad, it's who has power and who doesn't. And the people who have power are like one, causing this problem, and then taking advantage of it at the same time. So if we want to either talk about, you know, why is it a problem that are like that people are stuck in Mexico, or like what stake does both the Mexican and U.S. governments have in maintaining the status quo, and why has there been an increasingly a process of increasingly militarizing the border?
What do you want to talk about,
Martha? I just want to draw attention to like the historic like push pull between like nativist exclusion and capitalist attempts to, you know, import and export labor and draw people when it's convenient and push people out and kind of criminalize immigrants based on like what the economy demands and based on what profits you can make off of labor and off of bodies and how cheap you want it to be at some points, and how you want to emphasize like you know, patriotism and this kind of like white supremacy thing that we have going on sometimes when we talk about migration, or all of the time. So I just wanted to emphasize that and kind of draw that into the fact that like something like 3,500 troops were just sent to the border recently, and make sure that we're noting the historical precedence of this. And this is like not the first time that people have been criminalized for wanting to cross the border. You know, since the 50s, at least, we've had legislation, you know, making exceptions for some type of labor and excluding other types and pushing and pulling migrant workers.
Yeah, like knowing that history and like having this personal experience down in Tijuana, like what do you think we might see happen in the future with this crisis at the border?
Well, it's just, we learned that it's really going to be an ongoing crisis. This was happening before the caravan became, you know, made national news. And this is, you know, this is going to keep happening. There's going to be more people coming, particularly with, you know, as the climate crisis worsens and all that, we're just going to keep seeing these waves of immigration and reactionary things like this happening at the border. And one of the things that we learned is that with a new group of migrants coming up, they are being offered work visas in Mexico, and that there's a lot of misinformation around that, and that's something that can be really problematic because the Mexican government is kind of working with the U.S. government to try to keep people there, and they don't realize that getting something like that can actually harm their ability to come to the U.S. and get asylum. So, you know, again, all this confusion and misinformation is partly what's really problematic.
If we learned anything or think about, you know, the future of border crises, it's that the state is putting a lot of their effort into keeping people out and keeping people misinformed rather than creating the structures to support folks and have them enter and execute their right to asylum cases.
I have, lastly, really quick, one thing that was a couple days after we got back from the trip, something that was just really, really upsetting is we saw a headline about the Democrats willing to compromise with Trump to end the government shutdown by offering billions of dollars for border security, not the wall. And that is something that is an incredibly cowardly move and so deeply upsetting after our experience, learning that it's not just the crisis that's at the border, it's the crisis that's happening here with ICE terrorizing immigrant neighborhoods and all that. And people, you know, just renaming something border security does not mean that you're, you know, that it's a very cowardly move.
That is absolutely true. And I just wanted to thank you guys for sharing these like really personal experiences. And I hope it affects people to get involved and fight back against the terror of our, you know, immigration system. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI Radio in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. WBAI is not only funded by our listeners, but our board is democratically elected by our small dollar funders. Do you want to hear more socialist content? Do you want to make sure that Acid Reg gets paid? Become a WBAI buddy by going to give to WBAI.org. $10 or more a month makes you a sustaining member. Please call 516-620-3602 or text WBAI to 41444. Thank you very much. Now we're going to have Jordan join us to speak more about kind of the unique organizational structure that existed down in Tijuana, how they were responding to things, and you know what we can learn from their model.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Hi, New York. This is really important for us to talk about, and we wanted to emphasize it because the response to this crisis could be met in any number of ways. And there are all sorts of groups doing incredible work to try and do that. But what was unique about the organization that we were down there working with is that they emphasized a collective ownership of this process. They emphasized a model and an approach of organizing that I think was very unique to me. And I think you can hear in our discussions that you kind of called those recordings from that it felt unique, and even from our experiences in New York. And like what characterized that was this, they had this motto, which is after 12 hours, you're a veteran. And what that meant was you showed up the first day, you got oriented, you got trained, and then you jumped into the work for 12 hours. And the next day you were a leader. You learned your first day, you apprenticed your first day, and then you owned it. You were accountable to it from every other day that you were there after that. And that was really powerful, and you could see it in the way that all these people, like, because we were there for 10 days, and you would see, we saw some rotations of people in and out, as well as some people who were there for a very long time, and who were continued on past us for many months behind us and many months going ahead of us. And they're all volunteers. There were very few people there who were, like, paid staff of this organization. And the trust and the accountability they gave to everybody through a truly democratic process, whereby, like, at the end of the day, you
you sat down together and you were like, okay, these are the various things part of the operation to make this thing work every day, to help these people, to give childcare, to bring food, to do the Know Your Rights workshop, to help with the credible fear interview training. All of that required leaders, required people to like make sure that process ran every day. And you would find yourself after your first day, like I found myself after my first day becoming the leader of one of the ops and tech part of it. And that's the same for everybody. And that meant that at the end of each day, you had to make it better. You had to learn what it was, and you had to try and make it better each day.
It seems like a really incredible way to empower people in their organizing work. And we're going to continue to discuss this, but first we just want to open up the phone lines for our last 10 minutes of the show. We'd love to hear from you. Please give us a call at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877.
And I want to stress that, like, the reason this was so important, the reason this has so much meaning, this collective ownership of the process, this leaderful exchange of skills and ideas, was because it's core to the act of building community at that point of struggle. It's core to the idea of acting in solidarity. There's this Naguib Mahfouz quote I saw going around this week that was, home is not where you're born. Home is where your attempts to escape cease. And reading that, I thought of these people who are desperately seeking home, and all of these organizers working with everything they could to open that door to a home for them. And that's solidarity. That's what we do when we're doing our best. And it's because it builds a community. It creates a unity of humanity where there was only devastation there before. And that's because capitalism and imperialism destroy us. They, like, enact every day. They destroy our homes and they destroy our communities and our neighborhoods and our cities all the way up to the world. Like, we're living ecological crisis right now. And in the course of doing that, to make that work, to make it so it's difficult to fight against that, like you talked about Luigi, they divide us and they alienate us from each other and they dissemble these bonds of community that sustain our everyday lives with this constant hunger for extraction and the world and all of us in it. And so our relations to each other, our ability to organize on the ground and to care and support and teach and comfort each other, they're divided up with this competition and conflict that capitalism demands, which is that our schools and our hospitals and all these parts of our communities are sliced up into competition and markets for profit that have always been maintained by the violence of the state. And that's what the border is. It's political violence. It's the entirety of this capitalist and white supremacist project to, you know, like in quotes, secure the homeland. It's about extracting and exploiting and ultimately devastating the homes and communities of these migrants who only then naturally flee to make what we took from them, which is a home. And then they're met with this wall. They're met with a list and that's illegal, and these ice boxes, these hieleras, and the guns and the dogs, and this obscene demand to then like justify your fear. Prove to us who took everything you had, the severity of this devastation that we caused. And so that the wall, the border, it marks the ways that we're able to continue exploiting and oppressing them on our terms. It decides, like, it determines from these people who we're going to let in and let out by saying, is there a better profit utility in letting them through and letting us marginalize and oppress them on our terms inside the states? Or are we going to say, no, you can't, you have to go back home, and we're going to marginalize and oppress you and extract from your labor there in the way that we've always done? And so to organize, to do what we were doing there with this organization, to be in solidarity with these people in the way that we did, which was collective, it was non-hierarchical, it was with care and intention not to recreate those oppressions that brought them there into the first place, it's everything. I think that, like, all of us there in that building in Tijuana, like, bringing whatever experience and skills and means we could, like, gathering together with these migrants to share what was most needed, continuously and democratically determining, like, every day how to do that better. Like, better food, better childcare, more healthcare that they were scaling up in the time that we were there. Like, all about it, like, redesigning the operations every moment iteratively to suit the emergent needs that were changing all the time, too, of these people. So, like, the key that I think a lot of us took from it is that, like, what we experienced there organizing in this way that was so transformative, at least for me, and I don't want to speak for all of us, but, like, at least for me, it was, like, there were no heroes. Everybody matters, and everyone's accountable to each other in the work by owning it together. And that, like, all of us in that service of that beautiful outcome of, like,
creating a home for these people, these brothers and sisters who had had theirs like really violently taken from them. And it really impacted us. And so I want all of our work to be as beautiful as that. It doesn't have to be just in this crisis situation. It doesn't have to be just be like all hands on deck and then we can go back to some hierarchical, some really centralized and like rigidly formed way of working, that by giving everybody ownership, not just within us as organizers, but the people we're organizing with, unites our experience and creates like the ability for our potential of this big universal tapestry of the working class to actually form together, to weave together, to actually be united against these oppressions.
Yeah, like what it really highlights to me is in challenging the logic of capitalism, which is about devaluing humans, and for building socialism, the means are the ends.
Yeah.
That the way that people are organized is, at the end of the day, the key for building real power for all people. And I mean, I thought that was just a really beautiful summary of your thoughts from your experience down there. And we're going to go back to Maddie, who's going to, you know, tell us a little bit about what's going on in challenging the vicious deportation apparatus here in New York.
I could go on about that, but I'm going to be quick because I think we have to wrap up. Something that the Immigrant Justice Working Group has been working on for the past year or so has been, getting the community involved in fighting courthouse arrests, which have gone up 1,700% since Trump took office, and in the last year have gone up 20%, so still a really jarring escalation of courthouse arrests, which creates a cooling effect on people reporting abuses by their landlord, by their partner, by their workplace. So we're really trying to fight for equal access to justice for everyone in New York State, regardless of documentation status. So we're having an action tomorrow at 4:45 at the Capitalism Bowl off of Bowling Green. We're going to go to the Office of Court Administration. And this is coming off of a report last week. Excuse me, I'm recovering from pneumonia, from the Immigrant Defense Project, which has and documented the publication, which found hard evidence of collusion between the Office of Court Administration, the courthouse officers, and ICE. So we are really going to come out tomorrow at 4:45 at the Capitalism Bowl off of Bowling Green to say that this is completely unacceptable and a sanctuary state means no collusion between the courts and ICE at minimum. And also our next immigrant justice meeting is on February 12th at 6:30 at the CUNY Grad Center. And you can work with us to fight ICE in New York City.
And you can contact you guys at immigrant.justice@socialist.nyc.
That's right.
All right. Well, I wanted to thank our guests for really just an amazing show, diving into some really important topics and places where we need to be organizing to build socialism and fight against the real brutality of capitalist imperialism. You can follow us at Twitter at NYCRPM. Just thank you for joining us. We're going to go out with our solidarity forever, as we usually do. Thank you for listening to Revolutions Per Minute.